So Kathleen, is the sound quality good? Am I coming through okay? Okay, good. Thank you. Switched over to the AirPods. I wanted to make sure that they were doing their job. So, are there any announcements that anyone has of any kind of upcoming Dharma activities or related events that they'd like to share right now? If you have something to share, just unmute and speak up. No, I know that. Okay. So this evening I want to share with you basically, I guess, early steps on my own journey of inquiry, both into the teachings of the Buddha on the subject of caste, and also on the institution of caste at the time of the Buddha, and then parallels as well as differences between, with what we are encountering today in this country, how we got here historically, and where we might go from here in terms of a skillful application of what the Buddha had to teach in a realm of social and economic justice, and he did teach in that area. One of the things that I wanted to make sure of at the outset is that one of my favorite early Dharma books was called The Way of Xuanzu, and it was a translation of an ancient Taoist text by the Catholic monk Thomas Merton. And in the introduction to the book, he said, I wish to assure you, dear reader, in this translation that I have prepared, that my intention is not to magically pull Catholic rabbits out of Taoist hats. he wasn't trying to sneak in, like backdoor Catholicism into a Taoist text. And so I want to try to also assure people that I'm not trying to slip in a lot of progressive politics in the name of the Buddha, while also trying to be as clear as possible that the Buddha had a certain amount to say about the governance of society and the potential for the abuses of the caste system, even though he never spoke out directly against it as a means of social organization. He said that it is a system that's rife with the potential for abuse. Okay, so the path that I want to take us on tonight, and it is it's kind of an overview, and it's my first time really diving into these materials in any real detail. So be speaking first a little about what is known of the caste system in India at the time of the Buddha, and the caste system of which he was a part. The reasons why he established a spiritual community in which caste played no role. Looking at the evolution of the Indian caste system over time, especially where it stood in the 1700s, when the British were colonizing India at the same time they were colonizing the Americas, and aspects of the Indian caste system that were probably deliberately imported into the United States and became part of our you know, our heritage. Then a little bit about some of the caste residue or the kind of underlying features of caste in America, mostly again from the writings of Isabel Wilkerson. And then looping back and having a closer look at some of the Buddhist teachings on caste with regard to how we might begin to apply those in our situation today. It's a lot to cover, and again, this is kind of an overview, and that last piece on what do we find in the Buddhist teachings that is directly applicable to dismantling the caste system today. It's probably going to have to mostly wait for a second talk so we can go into that in the kind of detail that it requires. So you can think of this as the first of maybe a two-part series. And my scholarship, for the most part, or in large part, on caste at the time of the Buddha, as well as the teachings on caste, have drawn from the scholarship of Bhikkhu Bodhi, from his book, In the Buddha's Words, and also from his introduction to the Nikayas, the Majjhima Nikaya, the Digha Nikaya, and the connected discourses, where he references what the Buddha had to say on the subject. Okay. So caste in India at the time of the Buddha, caste was not a word familiar to the Indians. It was, the word has originated from the Portuguese, casta, means birth lineage. And in turn, they got the word from the Latin, castus, which means purity of lineage. And the Romans used this term as a way to differentiate their own ethnic lineages, their houses of the state in Rome, from those of what they called the mongrel cultures surrounding Rome and over which it had dominion. Okay, in other words, other cultures that weren't Roman. And so birth lineage in the terms of castes was purebred or unsullied, birth lineage free from barbarism. And that's what they call the system they found in India, which the Indians, the term in India is Varna. And at the time of the Buddha, there were four different blocks or hierarchically ordered groups in society. And one way to understand Varna at the time is simply in a descriptive way to talk about different categories of people inhabiting society. And the top caste in the Varna system were the Brahmins, who were priests and spiritual counselors. And the next caste down was the Kshatriya. They were warriors, public administrators, monarchs. The Buddha was a Kshatriya in that he came from a family of rulers of a tribal republic in northeastern India. His father was a kind of a minor monarch. Third caste was the Vaishyas, artisans, merchants, farm owners, people who were in the thick of it insofar as the economic activity of that little part of what had not yet even become India. It wasn't until 300 years after the Buddha's death that, that these little city-states and fiefdoms were organized into a country. Fourth caste was the Shudras, the unskilled laborers, including farm workers. And then outside of those four castes, there was another group that was considered so low as to be inadmissible to the caste system. They were variously known as untouchables, outcasts, or the unclean. And they performed functions that no one else would, like cleaning latrines and gathering livestock manure and all in the garbage, all of which carried a heightened risk of infectious disease. And so they were forbidden bodily contact with someone who is not also in touch with them. Over time, the caste system in India also became associated with skin color. The Aryan peoples who invaded from the north and gradually took over control of society were taller and lighter skinned than the ancient indigenous peoples of southern India, who were generally shorter and darker complected, sort of like the indigenous peoples of Central and South America. So that's the situation that the Buddha lived in when during his time. After a lot of modifications and whatnot, it was still roughly the system that the British encountered when they came into India and began to gradually assume a dominant role in the society through alliance with some of the warlords and feudal monarchs at the time. In order, they would empower them, make them fabulously wealthy in return for those people swearing allegiance to Great Britain. So this proceeded at pace, and the British loved the system. It said historically that the caste system in India was the most severely and rigorously enforced at law as well as by custom during the time of British colonialism, because it worked so well as a means of getting riches out of the Indian subcontinent based on either a very menial wages or actually slave labor. Same time, the British were colonizing the America, North America. And the problem they ran into in North America that they didn't encounter in India was there was no slave labor. There was no there are no menial laborers to go out and work the fields and otherwise create agricultural wealth. They tried enslaving indigenous peoples first, but didn't work out too well. They fought back, they ran away, they died of European diseases. And so what the British began to do was to import people, Africans, West Africans, who'd been kidnapped and forced into enslavement and hauled across the ocean. Same thing the Portuguese were doing at the time. They couldn't find the labor force they needed in Brazil and elsewhere, and so they kidnapped people in West Africa and hauled them off to Brazil. At the same time they were doing this, the British colonists in America ran into a bit of a problem in terms of the governing of their own society, because they were also religious. They considered themselves to be the ones who were, by virtue of their wealth and their power, at the top of European societies coming to the Americas, to be the natural-born leaders of society, just as the Brahmins considered themselves to be in India. But it's kind of hard to square being sort of God's chosen people with having your entire economy based on forced labor, and slave labor. And so they were among the first to conjure up and propagate these ideas of what they called race science. And essentially it was a belief structure that said that essentially what we have are several basically subspecies of human beings, and that just as in nature we can hierarchically order these various subspecies based on skin color and physical appearance. And so they had a rank ordered hierarchical caste system, essentially, that they expressed not in terms of caste, but in terms of the races. And so that's where the language that we use to this day came from. Race is a social construct. And when they ran the human genome, they found that 99% of the human genome is identical across every ethnic group in the world. So it's not something that ever had any basis whatsoever in medical science. It was simply a social construct to rationalize the way they were organizing society. So Isabel Wilkerson says that, you know, if we only constrain ourselves to using the language of slavers to describe the our current situation in the United States, it's kind of a cul-de-sac. That in order to get us where we need to go in terms of a more just and equitable society, we need to look behind the curtain. And she says the way to do that is to look at what race is a marker for. Basically, it's simply a means of rank ordering in the caste system. And Chief was inspired by an insight that Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King got after he visited India with his wife, Coretta, after the American Civil Rights Movement had really taken off and become, you know, known widely around the world. They went to India. When he went to India, he said, for me, this is kind of a pilgrimage. I want to be in the place, I want to experience the birthplace of nonviolent resistance to oppression, you know, the places where Mahatma Gandhi lived and worked. And when he arrived, and India had only been a free country for a little over a decade when he came there, and when he was received almost like a head of state, you know, the prime minister greeted him, and then there were garlands of flowers, and he was really treated like royalty pretty much wherever he went. He spent some time in the south of India, specifically because he wanted to visit the communities of the Dalits, the untouchables, the ones even below caste ranking. And he said that he was again graciously received, and people were really grateful for his visit and acknowledging them. And he said he had this really shocking experience when he was introduced by the leader of the Dalit community to this gathering. She said, the leader said, "I am proud to introduce to you America's most famous untouchable." He said at the time he was actually kind of disturbed, you know, felt mildly irked that he had been getting treated so royally all over the country, and now all of a sudden they were telling him that he was just another untouchable. And then he said it took a while to sink in, but he realized eventually that the Dalit leader was right. You know, he said, "I am an American untouchable. I live in a caste system in America that's every bit as real and powerful as the one that exists in India." And it was coming out of that experience that he gradually began to expand the scope of his advocacy. And, you know, he said that, you know, as this was happening for him, he said, "I realized that I was part of a caste which was functionally incarcerated by the economy, even though the Civil War had ended a century earlier. You know, that we are brutally segregated and confined to the very lowest rungs of the social order in America because the American economy requires slave labor now every bit as much as it did before the Civil War. And racism, as we see it, you know," he said, fighting for freedom from segregation, freedom from discrimination on the basis of skin color and race. But he said, what we're really fighting for is to break free of the caste system, because America still needs slaves, and they still need to have a class of people that they deliberately undereducate and disempower so they can have people to do menial jobs for very little money. And he said, that's what we need to break free of. And when he when he was assassinated in Memphis, he had embarked upon the expansion of this message. And he had gone there to support the Memphis garbage workers, garbage collectors, who were, you know, as he described them, America's untouchables. They were doing the work of untouchables. They were striking for better pay. And he made speeches pointing to economic inequity being as powerful as an oppressor as the color of your skin. And that's when his life has ended. The Poor People's March on Washington, led by Reverend Abernathy, came shortly after that. It was also the time that the American Civil Rights Movement began to wind down, because just like the Black Panthers did in Oakland, there was a refocusing on economic injustice. And that's where they kind of hit the wall and began to be disempowered. So, personally, another reason that I like using the approach of caste, you know, in addition to the insights that Reverend King had, is because of the way that America, in addition to social hierarchy based upon skin color, also has, every generation has its own untouchables. Right? And it's not always associated with skin color, it's not always associated with socioeconomic status. Women were a subcaste within a caste for, you know, up until, you know, first off, the enfranchisement of women in the 1920s, women's rights movement was an effort to break free of oppression within their own caste, even though the early women's movement, you know, the suffrage movement was thoroughly racist. And the leaders basically turned their backs on African-American women in order to get the votes of Southern white women necessary to achieve their political objectives. I speak of these things now because the outcasts of the latter third of the 20th century were queers, okay? Gays and lesbians, gender fluid people like me, those who were set aside, who were deemed unworthy of full participation, full membership in society. That ostracism, that defining as unworthy of equal acknowledgement, equal protection, is something that the Trump administration has been actively engaged in ever since he came into office. And so part of the struggle right now in civil rights is trying to call out that untouchable status for what it is and to bring it to an end. So so how did the Buddha deal with all this? At least looking at Nikho Bodhi scholarship, what he tells us is that the Buddha didn't call out the caste system itself. He didn't directly confront it during his time. But he offered teachings that can basically kind of be understood that way in the present day. the two main forms of governance at the time, according to the Bhikkhu Bodhi, were monarchical kingdoms and tribal republics. And the kingdoms were gradually getting bigger and more powerful, and were, you know, the big fish were eating the little fish. So he didn't speak for or against either style of government. But what he did do, and it's kind of interesting, he didn't start doing this directly until near the end of his life. And in the Parinirvana Sutta, it's the longest sutta in the discourses. It's about the Buddha's final days. And one of the things that he did during his final days, towards the end there, is he started offering direct advice to rulers in a way that he hadn't really been doing all that much before. And there was one ruler, King Ajasadu, who was thinking about invading some of the surrounding republics, and he asked the Buddha what he thought his chances of success were. And the Buddha said, well, you know, it's always easiest to conquer a country or a nation that's been weakened from within. And what weakens nations from within is when they are unstable, when there's a lot of internal strife. And if the country is peaceful and the people are supportive of their leadership and they feel that they're being well treated, they're loyal and they bear allegiance, and those are tougher to defeat. His advice, and the generic advice to this day, is called the advice to the wheel-turning monarch. And what he said was this. He went back to his teachings about the three poisons, the kalesas, greed, hate, and delusion. He said, when the mind is absorbed by the kalesas, by the three poisons, he called, there's no hope. There's no hope that one cannot begin to become free until you learn how to detoxify yourself, in terms of learning how to purify yourself from the influence of the kalesas. He said exactly the same is true in society. If you find a society that is polluted by these three toxins, in order to achieve the goals of the Dharma, you need to begin to detoxify the society. So he advised the kings on how to govern in accordance with the Dharma. And so there's a whole text around that that we can get into in more detail at another time. He didn't go after the caste system, but he and the Brahmins did not get along well at all. The Brahmin priests at the time, you know, they're two interpretations or meanings of the word Brahma in the time of the Buddha. One was a high-born member of the priestly caste, and what the Brahmins told the rest of the world was that you should think of humankind as the body of Brahma. And he said, we, the Brahmins, are sprung from the mind and the mouth of Brahma. You know, we are the brain, we are the intelligence, we're the ones who order and direct everything in the body of Brahma. The Kshatriyans are the arms, the strength, the force that's used to act, to acquire, to protect. The Vaishyas, the merchants, what they're sort of like the legs and the trunk, okay. And they provide the support for the body. And the lowest caste, the ones who touch the earth, you know, they're kind of like the feet, they do the grunge work. And the monarchs evidently had a pretty ambivalent attitude toward the Brahmins. They didn't particularly like it that the Brahmins were claiming to be the brains of the operation and the ones who were closest to God. What the Brahmins also said was, we are close to God because of all of our previous lifetimes in lower castes doing acts of purification and acting in accordance, dutifully acting in accordance with our role in the lower castes. And our reward for not coming up against the caste system, right? For just doing our job and doing our you know, puja. And of course, supporting the Brahmins handsomely. You know, you purchase merit through this giving wealth to the Brahmins, right? Sacrifices and money and stuff. Then your reward is to get reborn in a higher caste. And so they said, we were born into this caste. We were born into a pure state by virtue of all of our virtuous past lifetimes. Kind of self-serving. So the monarchs, on the one hand, liked that part of it because it was getting the Brahmins were telling everyone to chill out and just play your role in your caste and, you know, don't make trouble. But at the same time, they didn't like how much power the Brahmins were trying to assume in society. And so if you read, you know, as the Buddha's sanghas became bigger and more numerous and they were popping up here and there around northeastern India, Buddha had benefactors who supported him. And the benefactors, for the most part, were monarchs and really wealthy businessmen. Okay. So why would they support the Buddha at the same time the Buddha was taking pot shots at the Brahmins? Because the Buddha said, you know, your status in life as a Brahmin is not owing to your high birth in this incarnation. He said there are two ways the term Brahma can be understood. One, born to a particular caste. Brahma literally means holy one. Okay. And he said, one does not become a Brahmin by reason of high birth, you know, into a particular caste in this lifetime. One becomes a Brahmin by rebirth in the next moment based upon how you act in this moment. So he says, noble birth and noble rebirth is a function of how you act and the intention underlying your action. And so, in that way, he was basically undercutting the social authority that the Brahmins were trying to assert. And the monarchs and merchants, a lot of them actually thought that was a pretty good idea because they were looking for some checks on the power of the Brahmins. And so, you know, Jesus of Nazareth called out the priestly caste, and after 3 years they whacked him, right? Because the priestly caste told the Romans that he was actually trying to disrupt the economic hierarchy when in fact he was actually only, you know, creating a threat to the power of the Pharisees. Just a few elements of where the Buddha was coming from in terms of the governance of society. In terms of the governance of the Sangha, the principal condition of entry into the Sangha, of, you know, going to the Buddha for refuge, you know, and surrendering one's ego to the power of the Dharma in order to achieve awakening, freedom. Okay. The ritual of entering into the Sangha was one that consisted of shedding all trappings of caste. Okay. Whether low-born or high-born, when one entered the Sangha, one shed all of the clothing and adornment that bespoke any form of social rank from the highest to the lowest. Everybody in the Sangha wore the same color robes, and the robes were manufactured by taking recycled worn out clothing, cutting away the rotten parts, sewing them back together, and dyeing them down on riverbanks using the muds and the clays that were available there, which for the most part were ochre and saffron. Everyone shaved their heads. Okay, so it was in fact a casteless society. And the Buddha said that caste has no role in this sangha because of its potential for abuse, its potential to do terrible harm. And everyone had to take turns doing all the work, that, including the stuff they didn't necessarily like doing. Buddha used a couple of metaphors for describing the necessity of shedding caste on entering the sangha. He said, you know, there are many rivers that flow from many directions through their own geography. They, when they reach the ocean, they, at the coastline, they flow into the ocean, and they lose their name, and they lose their identity because they have become part of the one Dharma, the ocean of the Dharma. Another assembly he used was, he said, you know, if you start a fire and you put in and you feed the fire with different kinds of woods, okay, that have different properties, you know, they look different, they feel different, they're different weight when you put them in the fire, but then there's just a fire. And so he said the same is true of coming into the Buddha Dharma Sangha, right? We all become one by virtue of the fact how we take on the trappings of one, and we put aside our individuality in order to reflect that that reality. Okay. And he said, Dharma knows no caste. High or low birth into the next moment depends on the action that you take in this moment. There's a story of Ananda, the Buddha's attendant, his cousin, his closest friend, going on a mission for the Buddha. And Ananda stops along the way at a well to get some water, and there's a woman by the well, and he asks if he could, if she would draw him some water. And she says, oh no, Holy One, this I cannot do, for I am low-born, I am untouchable. If I were to draw you water, I would pollute you with my body, my hands. And Ananda replies, I did not ask for the circumstances of your birth. I asked for water. So what he's doing in that gesture is to set aside caste. He said, for me, caste is irrelevant. You know, what matters is your generosity and your gesture of kindness toward me and getting me some water. And so after this encounter, Bhakati, the woman at the well, she learns of the spiritual community that Ananda is a part of. She goes to the Buddha and says, I have just encountered Ananda, and I wish to serve him. I love Ananda for the way he treated me. And the Buddha said, well, you know, ultimately what you love about Ananda is kindness. And what you did for Ananda, your gesture of kindness, your gesture of generosity, right, is what is ennobling. It has nothing to do with the circumstances of your birth. It has to do with who you are on the inside. He said, you love Ananda. You found that you were moved by his presence because of his kindness and his openness. And that's the same thing that you've expressed. He said, and our understanding of how things are, that makes you nobly born. That sets you above the monarchs. It sets you above the Brahmins when you are behaving with kindness and generosity and they're not. So it's very unequivocal about that. You know, that in terms of awakening, caste is irrelevant. It plays no real role. Okay. He said it is our actions and their fruition that determine nobility or debasement. Whether in oneself or in one society. So that's what I've come across so far. And I'd love to discuss anything that I've touched on so far that's of interest to you. Just unmute and sing out.
Lloyd?
Please.
So I'm wondering how practice fits into this value system. Can we assume that daily practice allows us to express kindness and other valuable virtues?
I think that what it really calls on us to do from the standpoint of the Buddhist teachings about the destructive effects of the caste system and why he was adamant about the Buddha Dharma Sangha being a caste-free environment was because of its potential for abuse. And the fact that those who maintain the caste system and its structure were the ones who benefited from it. Okay. And so one of the areas, I think, for inquiry for all of us is, are there ways that we benefit from the existing caste structure that we're not even aware of? Okay, see if we can determine what those are. And what to do about them. What the Buddha said when he was talking about the wheel-turning monarch, in his teaching, he didn't condemn the caste system outright, but he did describe the symptoms of a society that had become polluted by the three poisons. He said, violence and crime in society can be traced to poverty. And poverty can be traced to scarcity. If the caste system is distorted, then it can create artificial scarcity, basically in order to keep people in their place. The artificial creation of scarcity can be traced to greed, the greed of the upper castes. So the foremost responsibility of the wheel-turning monarch is to ensure that everyone has the means to see to their own well-being. And I guess it's really up to us to decide how to go about helping to create a society where everyone has the means to see to their own well-being. Okay. That's something that I hope to dig into a little deeper, and maybe like you just asked, you know, to come up with some more specific thoughts about how one goes about looking at the Buddha's advice. I'm, you know, just based on that teaching of the wheel-turning monarch, really beginning to look harder at what creates conditions of scarcity in America. You know, how is it that, I think Martin Luther King was right. I think that the American economy, as he was experiencing it then, as we experience it now, is based upon, requires menial labor done for very low wages. Okay, the functional equivalent of slavery in the present day. I was reading an article today about the people working in the JBS meatpacking plant in Greeley. They're Burmese immigrants. They're Muslim immigrants from North Africa. They are basically doing the work of outcasts, right? President Trump a few weeks ago declared meatpacking plants to be essential services that were an absolute requirement of the American economy, and that meatpackers should be ordered back to work, and that they and that your employers should be free to fire them if they didn't return to work, whatever the circumstances there were. And JBS did just that. People that said, I don't want to go work in the plant today because it's too dangerous, they pulled their badges from them. They basically sent them home. It was like something, it was involuntary furloughing. And they said, don't come back till you're ready to work. So that's an example of the enforcement of the caste system, basically. My solution to that's to not eat meat. but I can't, I guess if each person needs to decide for themselves what's the best way to deal with that. Look for better enforcement of public health laws. I think, you know, what we're looking at basically, and it's been getting worse for a long time now, is radical inequality in the American economy. I think that needs to be addressed. I'm not going to, like I promised, I'm not going to get into, suggested political remedies. But I think that we, as a socially engaged Buddhist, am ardently in search of ways to better live the Buddhist teachings. It's a quest, I think, that for me is really just begun. Doing a lot of reading. There's a lot of interesting literature out there. How to Be an Anti-Racist is another title I'm finding to be really interesting right now. That has some pretty interesting parallels to Dharma. But, I wish I could just give you a checklist, things you ought to go do, but I think it's ultimately something that we need to start exploring in greater depth in ourselves. And when we get together in 2 weeks, I am going to share the results of my own exploration, again, doing whatever is possible to root it in the texts of what the Buddha actually had to say about social and economic justice. And at least according to Bhikkhu Bodhi, he had some things to say that I think are worth or are having a closer look at. Thank you. Good question.
Lloyd, Dorothy has her hand up.
Oh, Dorothy, please. Unmute.
Yep.
There you go.
Okay. Actually, can you hear me?
Yes.
I got to get closer to my computer. You just spoke about the comment I wanted to make, and that's when you were talking about Dr. Martin Luther King and how he felt really like an untouchable, and comparing that to the blacks today, and immigration, the immigrants came up in my mind, and how, and also, the snatching their children, separating them from their children is really a comparison to what we did with the slaves, and how parents and children were we're just separated. I mean, where have we gone? We haven't progressed very far there. But on a positive note, I just heard on the TV, I think it was yesterday, where you talked about the trash workers, and they showed a young black gentleman who was doing that to help his family. And he was so excited because he got accepted into Harvard Law School. So there we go. Awesome. Yeah, thank you.
Yeah. One way that I've heard, or one explanation for what's been happening in the country for the last 4 years, is a backlash to the election of America's first African-American president.
Mm-hmm.
That it was seen as an absolutely profound threat to the higher castes in American society. And the way that the last 4 years have mobilized and really amplified negative and destructive narratives of race in America can be attributed in part to that. So in some ways, having an African-American president who has a really interesting background, you know, because one of the means of maintaining the caste structure in America, making sure that we have classes of people who are going to all their lives be condemned to low-paying menial work, is to deny them the opportunity to improve their lives, especially, you know, it was illegal for anyone to teach slaves to, you know, enslave people to read, for instance, in the United States leading up to the Civil War. So Barack Obama basically had managed to get an elite education in American society, from Punahou School in Honolulu to Harvard Law, and that was, I mean, that can be seen as kind of paradigmatic liberation. He was an example of someone who blew it all away and who was able to really get out of that box and challenge the existence of the box. And then the last 4 years have been seen as kind of a reaction to that. Now what we might be looking at coming up is a reaction to the last 4 years. Well, I have to see how that manifests. But one of the things that traditionally has been done from the time of the Indians on and forward was to use the caste just above the most oppressed one to police the caste just below them. So in the case of the current day, you know, there's a lot of messaging from the president, you know, and George Wallace did this. It's been a trope in American politics throughout the late 19th, early 20th century is, you know, Richard Russell did it. Kingfish did it in Louisiana in the 1930s. He was telling his low caste white followers, you know, you may be poor and uneducated, and at the bottom of the heap here economically, but at least you're white. And it's the ones just below you who are threatening you. They want your jobs. They're competing with you in an effort to better themselves, and your job is to police them, to keep them from being able to rise up. There's a really interesting book. It's written, I guess, about 15, 20 years ago now. It's called How the Irish Became White. Basically, it's a discussion of caste in America and what happened when the the really large scale Irish immigration to the United States in the mid to middle part of the 19th century into the latter part of the century, that they were in the north, they were at the absolute bottom of the heap, you know, and they were taking the most menial, most dangerous jobs they possibly could. And then little bit by little bit, they were able to establish employment, policing the caste just below them. So they eventually managed to get into urban police departments and urban fire departments, especially in the police departments. Their job was to police the caste system, especially those the next rung down, which they did very effectively. And it's argued that right now, in today's time, I think I mentioned this, I don't know whether it's in our Sangha or on the Tuesday morning sit, that I used to teach in the criminal justice program at the University of Colorado in Denver in the School of Public Affairs. And that program was training people who, most of whom were already police officers, to be senior management, to be commanders and police chiefs, people like that. And when we really got to talking about race and class in America, you know, something that we began to routinely acknowledge is that what police departments are really hired to do is enforce the caste system. It's to protect people who have wealth and influence from those who don't. No one wants to admit that, you know, but that's pretty much how it's come down. And now when that's being done in ways that the public is ashamed of or doesn't like, the tendency is to blame the police. And so some people in police management are saying, well, wait a minute, why don't you have a look at what political leaders are actually telling us to do and what they actually pay us to do and why they want us to do it? Why do they, you know, why do we criminalize poverty? Why do we criminalize mental health? You know, mental illness, you know. Why do we make so many things in our society crimes? Why do we criminalize drug addiction? There's so many social ills we suffer from that could be so much better addressed by other means, you know. And it would cost more money, because all you do is keep increasing our budgets so we can keep suppressing people who have problems that need to be addressed. So, yeah, there's a whole lot that's being called into question now about how we do and don't expend our wealth, how we do and, you know, how we want to live together and what it's going to take to make it possible in keeping what the Buddha had in mind. Thank you. Anything else? Okay, good friends, here we are. Time for us to, I guess, go our separate ways now. And remember what makes one nobly born. Let's settle into our sitting posture again for just one moment. Oh, nobly born, you who are the son or daughter of the Buddha, remember who you are in these times of change. Remember the Buddha who has taken birth in your very own form. Step out of the small self, this body of fear, and rest in kindness and generosity of heart. Rest in your own true virtue and wisdom, the dedication and equanimity and compassion you share with all beings. For that is who you really are. trust it and rest in your own true nature. Have a good week, everybody. Stay safe and be well.
Thank you, Lloyd.
Thank you, Lloyd.
Thanks, Lloyd.
Thank you.
Thank you, Lloyd. Thank you, Tara.
Hey, Lloyd, what would you like to call your talk?
Okay. Buddhism and caste in America.
Okay.
Roman numeral one.
We learned a lot, Lloyd. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Well, you know, the problem with being an ex-academic is I far too easily fall into that mode.
Yeah. Oh, we eat it up. It's good. Thank you. Have a good week.
Okay.
Thanks, Lloyd.
Lloyd, have a good week.
Bye.
Good night, everybody.
Good night.
Good night.
Thanks, Kathleen. Too.
Lloyd, my friend from New Zealand sent me the link to that article. So it's all over the world.
Oh, interesting. Yeah, a lot of buzz. She has a book coming out next month on the same thing. I think it's probably going to be well received.
Yeah.
Did you email it to Kathleen?
I'm sorry?
Could you email the link?
Sure, yeah.
That'd be great. Thank you.
I think she was originally from Kerala, and so Kerala, I think, is where Martin Luther King was, you know, that's where the Dalit.
Oh, yes.
So
right.
She was interested.
Right.
Yeah.
Isabel
Wilkerson?
Yes. Uh-huh. America's Enduring Caste Problem. Mm-hmm.
Good night, everybody.
Good night.
Have a good week.
Good night, Lloyd.
Good night.